We made this.
Hello everyone and welcome to The Time Is Now, a weekly podcast discussing the 1996 Chris Carter show, Millennium. I am your host, Kurt North. Soylent Green is people. Millennium aired between 1996 and 1999 on the Fox network, and its pilot episode earned a total of 17 plus million viewers in the United States. Today, we're going to be speaking generally about Millennium overall, just before we get into the main podcast. The main focus for today is to generally talk about the show, its three seasons on air, and how we have come to appreciate it. Rather than me blab on, I have got two guests with me. They are Adam Chamberlain and John Kenneth Muir, both of which have contributed to the Back to Frank book, and they will also be contributing some of the episodes that you'll hear as we go through all three seasons. Welcome to the show, guys. How are you both doing?
Thank you very much. I'm doing very well, thank you.
I'm doing great. I'm very glad to be here.
Before we go into Millennium, can you give us a bit of background on yourselves? I mean, I know that we've briefly spoken about the book there. I mean, how was that pulling that together with the various different articles that you've got within that book for a start off? And I'll leave that with Adam first.
Sure, yeah. So it was a lot of work, but it was very, very rewarding experience, I have to say. It was a consequence of having been asked to do it by James McLean and Troy Foreman, who were behind the Back to Frank Black campaign. And a wealth of that material actually came from them as well, of course, because they had interviewed so many of the cast and crew. And so we had some great content to draw upon. And it was, for me, it was a chance to delve back into the show and go deeper than I ever had before, exploring themes, working with, again, with some of the cast and crew, but some of the writers that we were able to bring to that who had fantastic insights and just wrote some great material, including, of course, John.
Yes, and you know, I'm sitting right now with a copy of the book that Adam sent to me. It's on my lap right now with a card that Adam wrote and signed, and I am very proud to have been involved with this book, with Back to Frank Black. I think it's a great book, and it captures so much of what fascinates us, I think, about Millennium. You know, and when you look at the diversity of the articles, of the, you know, the stories, the in here about the show, I just think it's really amazing the different interpretations, the different interests even within Millennium. It's really great. So I'm very proud to have been involved with this book.
One of our initiation questions that we're going to be doing throughout the show, any new guest that comes on, we'll be giving them five initiation questions, and the first one we're going to be asking is, when did you first discover Millennium? So for both of you, when was that, and how did that come about from your point of view? When was your first recollection of seeing Millennium? I will start with John first.
Well, unlike the X-Files, I was with Millennium right from the beginning. You know, with the X-Files, I looked at the title and let's just say some of the effects were not yet what we would consider fully realized. I saw the trailers for that on Fox and I thought, oh boy, this looks like National Enquirer television. But my wife started watching it, so I started watching it and seeing how brilliant it was. So by the time Millennium came around, I was ready to be with it. So I started with Millennium right from the beginning, from the very first episode, from that great pilot. And it's just been ever since. I love Millennium.
Yeah, so similarly, I was on board from the beginning, but being based in the UK, this was back in the days where you had to wait nigh on a year for stuff to travel across the Atlantic, which was a bit painful. So I'd heard about it before I got the opportunity to watch it. I was already a fan of the X-Files, and the prospect of something new from Chris Carter on this theme with Lance Henriksen was I was chomping at the bit to see it. But it was the videos. There were a set of videos released of the first season, and I bought them all, and that's how I consumed the first season. So as soon as I could get my hands on it, I did.
We've all seen it from the pilot then, effectively. Now, you know, the next episode is going to be on the pilot. But what were your first impressions?
It's such a a great pilot in, I think, in terms of how it sets out its stall and its themes and so on. This it's so dense, there's so much crammed in, and so I was I was hooked right from the off, and I think it was so carefully put together as well, every element of the production, from the script through to the performances, especially Lance's, and then the look of the show. It was kind of unlike anything I'd seen at that point, and I was bowled over from day one.
What about yourself, John? How did you feel after watching the pilot episode for the first time?
Yeah, I was stunned. I had been watching The X-Files, and I knew that they were going, and it was feature film quality in terms of how the camera moves, performances, things like that. But Millennium, I mean, really could have been a movie. You had 15 minutes to it. That pilot could have been a feature film. And not just in terms of presentation, but also in its handling of the material, both the, in terms of, I don't want to be too great, but in terms of like sex and violence, in terms of what the camera was actually seeing, to me, I certainly saw it as pushing the envelope for what was permissible on network television, circa 1996. Remember, this is the era where, Home, that X-Files episode, was banned from American television after one airing, not to be seen again for many years. And the pilot was, again, very edgy like that. I was pushing that envelope, going over, transgressing to the edge of these taboos and beyond. But to me, what made it palatable, because you'll hear people say how dark Millennium is, and of course it is, but what made it palatable were the counterbalancing things, the views of family and home and things like that. So for me, it was this very tantalizing experience, like, wow, I can't believe I'm seeing some of these things on TV, but look how intelligent it is. Look, there is this gore and this ugliness, and then there's also this brightness through Frank and his family and his yellow house and things like that. So to me, it just seemed like I was watching what really seemed like a very well-developed kind of artistic statement from Chris Carter right out the gate, whereas I'm a huge X-Files fan as well, but I think I would say like X-Files maybe developed that like over, a year or two, maybe three, to where it just got to be perfect and it like just nailed it week after week. But like, if you look at the first couple episodes, they're still figuring it out. Whereas like Millennium, it like just lands in that pilot, and it seems like almost perfectly realized to me.
The first season especially it does have a quality where the X-Files, as you say, does take a while to find its feet. There's little episodes here and there that there's the execs getting involved, bringing in an ex-girlfriend and things like that, where they're still trying to work it out, where this seems very, very set in what it wants to do, and with Chris Carter's vision, really. So the second question that I would ask in the initiation ritual, as we call it, is your favorite episode. So Adam, what would be your favorite episode, and which season would that be in?
So I mulled this question over. So I'm almost tempted to pick the pilot, actually, for the reasons that John's just talked about. It felt it arrived so perfectly formed. But I think I did this once before, where we picked our top five episodes in a podcast for the Back to Front Black campaign, and I'm going to stick with what I chose there, which is the season two episode Luminary. Just for how it was just so lyrical. I loved the sort of mystical aspects of it. It reintroduced sort of Catherine and in an interesting way, and the fact that it was bookended by this dance that Frank was doing with the group at that time in terms of his own initiation and so on. I absolutely love that episode. So that would be my choice.
Well, Adam, that was a brilliant choice. That Luminary is so great. And, the thing about, I think, Millennium is, there are a lot of dark stories which are absolutely great. And Luminary has that, but it also has this millenniumistic quality, let's say, where it's also showing something inspiring and beautiful about the human condition and this young man who was able to move away from what he saw as the failings of the world, our consumerism, all the crazy, kind of things happening in the culture, the focus on materialistic things, and he was moving beyond that, and you saw how his journey resonated with Frank and what he was going through. So I just want to say I love that choice. That's in my top five, maybe. my number one as well. You know, it's very hard to pick because the pilot was absolutely so brilliantly done, so perfectly formed, luminary, such a great upbeat show. You know, I would have to go to, you know, as far as my favorites, you know, one of the Lucy Butler episodes, probably from year one or two. Very different stories, but Lamentation, I hope I'm saying that right, was the first.
That was the first one.
The first Lucy Butler in the first season. Absolutely terrifying episode. There are some moments in that with the home invasion where I just remember the first time I watched it, I felt like my heart was going to beat out of my throat. You know, I thought it was coming out. It was so, you know, terrifying. And the second season one, Room with No View, isn't terrifying, but it kind of almost plays in the same venue or idea of Luminary, this idea of, you know, sort of special people being told that they're not special and like killing that joy or love. I mean, you know, that Lucy is doing that. She's making people feel ordinary. Yeah. I mean, that is such a bizarre story. And I know some people don't like it, but I find it absolutely incredible and inspiring in its own way. This, you know, just this idea of, you know, these people are out there, and that doesn't mean just that they get really good grades or things like there's something special about them that people are attracted to. And that's what real goodness is. And that's the thing that the devil wants to kill, that sense that you're more than just an ordinary person. So I know I've rambled and given more than one answer. Adam, you know, I was honestly going to bring up Luminary just because that was in the mood I'm in today as far as something upbeat and happy. But you said it so well, Adam, so I just gave a couple other ones.
No, don't worry about that. I mean, mine would be complete opposite. Mine would be The Curse of Frank Black. I think that episode is amazing. I've done my fight initiation questions as it happens in a future episode, so I'll just jump in with mine. But The Curse of Frank Black to me is such a unique style and a new, unique story that we get told, and the way that that is really crescends to where Frank is at that point, I think is a fantastic one. Luminary for me, I think is one of, I would agree, is one of my favorite episodes of the entire run. I think that also the way you were saying about how he gives up everything just to go into the wilderness and to leave everything behind. But what I particularly like about that episode as well is the way that at the very end, the parents just don't understand. They don't understand why, and they can't get the head around why he's done that. And they're just on a different plane to where he is. And I think that was really well done. And Frank's, I think at that point as well, the way that Frank is so resolute in what he's doing with that he's not going to give up on that kid, and his, as you say, his initiation also is a really important part to it.
And it's based on a true story, of course, as well, right? So the book Into the Wild.
Yes, Into the Wild. Yeah.
John Krakauer. Yeah. So about this guy, Chris McCandless, who had done exactly this, gone out into the wilderness, but I think it had just been transformed into a story that fit Millennium perfectly. So that's sort of in the adaptation process as well. I think it was a perfect fit.
God be it that if anyone is actually listening to this and hasn't watched Millennium yet and to get involved in it, it's certainly going to be a high bar to get into. But if you were to give a flavour of what Millennium's about, I know it's very difficult with the three types of seasons that we have with Millennium. What episodes would you kind of point to somebody who's wanting to get into the show and really look at it? Especially with now, you look at likes of Hannibal and TV shows now being as dark as they are, it's more acceptable now to be in that kind of dark mindset. So what sort of episodes would you point towards for a newcomer to get into, maybe like a very short abridged season? Silence.
Wow.
I mean, the pilot is a perfect place to start. And, you know, for all of its great, like, setting up of the story, it also gives you a very thrilling kind of hunt the serial killer story. So, I mean, it works. It's not too hard to enter there. You know, that really is the best place to enter. But, you know, if you're not going to start there, I'd say an episode like The Mikado, which is just like this bang up, perfectly paced, perfectly produced, ends on a kind of terrifying, the killer is still out there, you know, rip-roaring procedural, I mean, boom, there it is. Like, the Mikado is like a perfect serial killer procedural, if that's what you're into. Like, you know, it almost seems like you ought to start there instead of something which is, like, a little off or different, like, you know, Beware the Dog or Monster or somehow Satan got behind. I love all of those episodes, but it's like, that's not where you want to enter. You probably, you know, you want to enter somewhere, you want to enter on ground level so that you can kind of take in a couple episodes and then be ready for those, you know, miraculous flights of fancy, like, Sound of Snow. Is that right?
Am I getting that? Yeah.
Sound of Snow. Yeah. You know, you want to make sure you know, but before you hit that, some of those more ambiguous type stories, you want to get your grounding in who Frank is. I mean, because really, I mean, I think, you know, Kurt, you mentioned like the three different seasons and how different they are. The thing you have to know first is Lance Henriksen is, you know, the star, but Frank Black is sort of the sun in that everything orbits him. No matter what kind of story is going to be told, Frank is like this object, the center of gravity for the story. So you want to meet him, you know, and see his life and get all that down, his love for Jordan, the yellow house, all that. That's, to me, the center of gravity for the show.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Yeah, and I think for that reason, you have to start with the pilot. I think the Mikado is a great choice as a sort of standalone if you just wanted to see that sort of showcase. But the pilot, and also Gehenna, I think, is a very important episode. I think that's the first time you really see this sort of demonic representation of evil that obviously becomes very important to the concept of the series, and especially as it goes on. So I think those two have to be the starting point for me. But and then John's already referenced Lamentation, which of course is a very pivotal episode in terms of the mythology as it develops. But
I think if you're coming from not so much an X-Files point of view, but coming from an X-Files kind of type show, if you're expecting it to be like the X-Files, it's not. It's very different. But I would probably go down the route of somewhere like Force Majeure, from the concept of it's got a bit of everything in there. It's got a bit of a foretelling of what happens in season two, but it's a little bit like an X-Files story at the same time. And obviously the pilot has to be the one, without a doubt. But I think as far as the Millennium and the end times, because Force Majeure is one of the first ones that actually sets a date in some way.
Yeah, it's true. And also it has Brad Dourif, so X-Files fans will appreciate a great turn from him.
Absolutely. Okay, so that leads me on to the third question, which is, what is your favorite season, Adam?
I agonize over this question as well, almost as much as the favorite episode. So I feel I should pick season one because it's just such a pure statement of what Chris Carter and co initially set out to explore. But I'm going to have to pick season two, I think, for how how creative it was, how it sort of broadened the canvas, how bold it was, the sort of the myth arc that it introduced, and I would go plus it has two Darren Morgan episodes, and anything with Darren Morgan in it is going to instantly elevate it above everything else. So you get the extra bonus points for that. I would go as far as to say it's probably my favorite season of any television show. So I have to go for season two.
High praise indeed. What about yourself, John?
Kurt, you might as well ask me to pick between children, right? you know, one of the really, I think, fascinating things about Millennium, and I guess many people will see it as a weakness, but I prefer to see it as a strength, is that it really does embody and encompass these different storytelling styles, and I really like them all. And I think they sort of make sense in the way that they're different in the times that they are in Frank's life. I mean, I think the first season, like I said, is this fully realized, brilliant work of art. It's like some of those stories, it becomes a little daunting at times. The stories are all beautifully wrought but a little similar, and so even though you're seeing like these fantastic stories with symbolism, you know, incredible camera work, you get to the end a little bit and it's like, okay, so you know, it is a lot of that serial killer of the week. One of the real virtues, I think, of season two is that it did just what Adam said. It opened up the world into these other avenues. So we got more into the end of the world type things. We got more into an examination of really what is the Millennium Group. We began to understand it and contextualize it in a different way than it just being a group of, you know, former FBI agents working to solve crimes. We started to see it more as a religion, or dare I say it, cult, right? And then I just want to put in my two cents for season three, because of course that's the one, you know, nobody ever picks season three. But I actually really like season three. You know, season two was brilliant, but it was dealt a pretty strong hand. It was dealt a very strong foundation. We left in the middle of a good cliffhanger. It picked up that cliffhanger, and then it could sort of lift off from there. We must remember that season three started with a cliffhanger that was virtually impossible to resolve. I mean, it would have been a completely show. It would have been Frank Black in, you know, the Mad Max wasteland, or, you know, something like, you know, Frank Black in Resident Evil. So they had to take what they could. They had to go in a different way. But, and I know many people don't like this, it makes a lot of sense to me that the group is the villain of season three, showing the growth between seasons and what we know occurred at the end of season two. I mean, what are you going to do? Is there any other story to tell there except Frank's rebellion from the group and what it has done? And I think there are a number of really incredible and bizarre and ambitious episodes in season three. I mentioned one earlier, The Sound of Snow. Was it Saturn Dreaming of Mercury? Seven and One. You know, there are some really bizarre, almost impenetrable episodes, but that are really rewarding to rewatch, like Bardo et al., things like that. You know, there's just so I can't pick, but I'm going to say, you know, I don't think it's a weakness. I think it's actually a strength that the seasons are so different.
The one thing I wanted to pick up on with regards to season, now we've briefly just spoke about it there, but there are reasons why they are so different. Do you want to just elaborate on that a little bit for us, Adam?
Sure, yeah, and I guess it was very much about the showrunners and what Chris Carter was trying to juggle at the same time, which was the behemoth that was the X-Files, right? So the if I recall this correctly, so the second season, so the first season, obviously Chris Carter was there. He was overseeing things as the main executive producer, albeit alongside the X-Files. Yeah. For the second season, he just didn't have the time. I think they were also working on the X-Files, the first X-Files movie, at the same time as well. But I don't think he was involved in the decision to hand the show to Glenn Morgan and James Wong, if I recall this correctly. I think it was a decision that was made by Fox sort of independently of him, and it sort of came as a surprise to him when he found out. But they'd been such a success on the X-Files that they really seemed sort of obvious people to hand it to. And so you had them coming in with their own sort of vision, and as we touched upon already, the things that they were more interested in exploring in terms of the slightly more sort of supernatural elements and the apocalyptic elements, and really delving into the nature of the group. And then then they exited at the end of the second season, and I forget the precise circumstances for that as to why that happened. But then for the third season, certainly Chris Carter came back, but it was really Ken Horton and Chip Johannessen who were the main showrunners there. So you had these three different showrunners, each with their own sort of visions. And as John said, for that third season, very much having to play the hand they'd been dealt, and I'd agree with John. You know, they really do it very well. So I certainly don't want to diss the third season either. There's a lot to enjoy there too. So it was really a consequence of the just keeping the show going and such a demanding schedule, and obviously Chris Carter not being able to do that alongside the X-Files, and therefore other people coming in and having their own vision.
Yeah, I think I might be misremembering this potentially, but I think the beginning of season three, was that Michael Duggan?
Oh, you're right. Yes. So
because he had the first, I think it was like the first 6 to 8 episodes where,
yes,
it's probably the, I mean, as you said, John, the fact that they haven't come back from this, spoiler alert, apocalyptic thing that's happened with the Marburg virus, that having to come back and retell that story. But I think they really struggled over those first 6 to 8 episodes to really get over that. I think there was conflicts with even during the course of season 3 where Michael Duggan eventually left and as you say, Chris and Ken took over there. There was also, you're right with the Fox thing, I think. I think from recollection, I might be, again, misremembering this a little bit, but they wanted it. A lot of the criticism of the first season, and John alluded to this before, was the serial of the week, yes. Which killer of the week, which probably is a bit of a disservice. Yes, the majority of them were, but there were episodes, like I said before, like Force Majeure, the well-worn lock was kind of a different type of episode, as well as The Wild and the Innocent. So there was stuff like that was flying around. From some of the readings that I've read, I think it's in the book that you're both in. The Wongs wore a 98% less serial killer T-shirt, which instantly reminded me of Ridley Scott in Blade Runner when he wore his own Spartan Xenophobia Sucks T-shirt when the American crew for Blade Runner were kind of going against the fact that Ridley Scott was coming in and telling them what to do. So that instantly reminded me of that. Yeah, so season one, we've got very broad stroke. We've got serial killer of the week. Season two was more about the Millennium Group and the apocalypse, and season three was the turnaround and the fact that Frank was to investigate the Millennium Group as such. So we've got three very different seasons in there. And as John alluded to there, it's definitely something that has its own stylistic approach and the way that it is viewed. And season three, unfortunately, is something that people perceive as a bad season. I think The Sound of Snow, personally, just as a note here, that I think that's one of my favorite episodes. I think it's a fantastic episode. If we just we're talking about the seasons, but if we just talk overall about this second season is such a can be an abstract season in some ways. We're getting things like brought into like the owls and the roosters in the two-parter, and you mentioned Beware of the Dog there, which has discussion on evil and the balance of power. What were your thoughts on season two as a whole with regarding to the arc, John?
I love season two. I do tend to gravitate just in my interest. That shouldn't be a surprise to anyone. I do like, you know, more sort of supernatural science fiction horror. You know, the police procedural, I think, is interesting, but, you know, you do it too much and it becomes very formulaic. So for me, what season two was about was taking Frank into that bigger realm and asking more sort of existential questions about who we are, who we've been, what are the things we're dealing with, how do we face the end, and even, I mean, the whole owls versus roosters thing, it's fascinating, but I mean, it's just perfect. It's a microcosm for how we fight, you know, about, you know, views of religion, you know, or even now, you know, religion and science, whatever. It's like, the world is going to end here. No, it's going to end here. Well, we believe different things, so we're going to have to kill each other, right? I mean, it's...
Yeah. Sounds a lot like Brexit.
Right, exactly. Exactly. I mean, you know, in a way, it's just really fascinating, you know, from an American standpoint, you know, the 90s, that time when Chris Carter's works just achieved such power here for us, that was the decade really where we began to see these divisions here at home in America between, you know, red and blue states, Republicans and Democrats, you know, I mean, where it was like two people with opposing views would look at the same person, like President Clinton and what he did, and he was either the greatest person in the world, the greatest president we had in a while, or he was like absolute evil, you know, and these divisions, you know, so there's something in Millennium about that kind of division, like even in the Millennium Group, which I think is interesting. And, you know, again, we're looking at a period of in America, the Cold War is over. It's supposed to be peace and prosperity. Everybody's doing well. The internet's creating this boom. And yet we're all terrified. We're all terrified of these existential things like this, like the things you're seeing in season two. You know, why is that? I mean, I talk about it a lot in my books about it being like anticipatory anxiety. Like, we knew what the good times weren't going to last. We were turning on each other. I don't know. You know, and then, of course, we had 9/11 and all that in the beginning of the next century, shortly after the millennium. And you can almost go back and look and say that's what millennium was like, sort of leading us to see that there were all of these things on the horizon that we weren't dealing with, that were going to make us reexamine ourselves.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because I often hear people say that Millennium was ahead of its time and so on. But really, it was, and I guess it was in some ways in terms of what it was putting onto television. But in terms, it was very much a response to those anxieties that you're talking about there, John. So it was, it felt very timely. So it was. So Chris Carter called it said it was about the anxiety of an age that didn't know how anxious it was about to become, and for that matter, still is, right? And therefore, right. Why Millennium still endures and still feels relevant, I think. But I completely agree.
This is going to be an interesting one for you. Who is your favourite character? Now, it doesn't have to be Frank. It doesn't have to be Catherine. It could be Lucy Butler. It could be someone who's just been in for 1 week, or it could be someone who's in every single episode. So who would be your favourite character, Adam?
I'm going to pick two if that's okay, because I think what? By default I'm drawn. Well, I am drawn. If I had to pick a favorite, it is Frank Black, and I think because I just he was such a unique, iconic hero. He is such a unique and iconic hero. The fact that you've got an older hero who's very much a man of integrity, who dares to look sort of deeply into the darkness and this, all the sort of personal risk and the personal sacrifice that he takes for that. Lance Henriksen's performance in that role was just fantastic. I can't say enough good things about that, to be honest. And inspired me to actually go and study psychology and criminology. I went and did a degree just because I was so enthralled by this character and what he represented and what he was looking to. More superficially is the reason I drive a red Jeep that's parked outside. but that feels like sort of the obvious answer to say Frank. So if I had to pick somebody else, the other character that I would call out, it would actually be Emma Hollis, because I think it was so almost potentially quite risky to introduce a new co-lead in a third season of a show. And I think it's too Claire Scott's credit that it was such a success, it worked so well, and so I would want to give Emma Hollis a call out, because I think she tends to be somewhat overlooked, but my honest and first answer has to be Frank Black for everything that character has and continues to mean to me.
Well, we'll come back to Emma Hollis, because I want to go through some of the characters anyway, so we'll come back to her and what she gave to the show. John, what about yourself? Who would be your favorite character?
Well, Adam, you said that brilliantly again. I think Frank Black is the obvious but also the worthwhile choice. And for me, it is that he is this older man but also a very gentle man. Frank, you know, one of the things that I love about him is that he sort of gets the idea that when he's yelling or angry, he's losing. And I love the way he'll walk into a scene and there'll be some obnoxious local policeman who's giving him guff or something. And he'll just state flat out what the facts are and he'll move on and he won't rise to the bait. I love his calm. I love the fact that he's brilliant and he doesn't have to shout or yell at people to be brilliant. I love his monologue about seeing even the biggest sort of monsters that he deals with in society as he sees the fact that they were once children. He has that monologue in Monster where he talks about the birth of Jordan. And he talks about, that you have to remember these people, they came into the world new like that too, that they were innocent too. And to me, that is just beautiful. And I think that what is so amazing about him is his calm, his patience, his gentle side. I mean, that's just not what you see on American TV as an action hero. You know, to some extent, all policemen, authority figures in American television, they're all descendants of cowboys, you know? And he's not. He's just so not that. You know, Lance Henriksen is quite amazing and fantastic to look at, but he's not, I would say it's not like he's like traditionally like young and like a supermodel. You know what I mean? He doesn't look like he was picked out of a catalog. He's interesting. He's intellectual. He's gentle. I love that about Frank Black. Adam made a great case for Emma Hollis, and I love her. I think she's fantastic as well. I would just give a shout out to Peter Watts, who is somebody that you think when the series starts is this sort of amazing person who is like Frank and who has had to give up things and, you know, has really faced these issues. And then you sort of see him succumb, that he's succumbed to something. His fears have gotten the better of him, whereas it's always a battle for Frank that he, even though he has those anxieties and fears about George, he doesn't succumb to them. He has a strength we see at the end that Peter Watts does not, and it makes Peter Watts a tragic character. So I find those characters fascinating, but especially Frank.
I think I would agree with all of what you said there, and there's so many great characters in there. I for definitely have an unhealthy opinion on Lucy Butler. She does something. I'm definitely succumbed to her ways, but Lucy Butler, I think it was a fantastic addition. And what I really really like about Lucy Butler is that she's appears in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 episodes, but even out of those five, there's only two episodes where she appears very very briefly. But she's still the character of Legion, and we'll get into Legion in a bit of time. But you look at Lamentation and A Room of No View and Antipas are the main episodes that she's focused on. And, you know, we've got, I think it was Pepper in Powers. I love this title. Powers, Principalities, Thrones and Dominions. So she only literally appears in a supermarket for half a second, and that's her view in there. But the whole episode is cycling around that presence of Lucy Butler. And I think that over the three seasons, she's a real good shout out for one of my favorite characters. And A Room with No View is definitely one of my, if not probably top five episodes of the entire run, personally. Going back to Frank Black though, and we'll go back into get your opinion on Lucy Butler in a minute, as well as Emma Holly, Peter Watts. But Frank's, what did you think? And over the course of the three seasons of Frank's gift, Chris Carter has said originally that it wasn't to be supernatural. We get episodes in the likes of, I would say, a single blade of grass, and then obviously what we get going beyond there. So, what's your thoughts and feelings on Frank's gift?
Well, there are clearly two views. That one is that he is just an especially insightful and empathetic person, and that's what allows him to slip into these sort of minds that he's able to understand because he's able to put himself out there and empathize so much with others. And then, of course, the later view is that he's, you know, a flat out psychic and he's receiving psychic visions. I think the superior idea is the empathy. And what I went and I talked about before about Frank and seeing them as children and how he describes his daughter's birth and how they didn't think they'd be able to have children and what that moment was like for him. Again, you know, you see this whole picture of Frank. I was talking about being this gentle, intellectual, quiet man who doesn't have to constantly prove he's, you know, the alpha dog. His gift fits in with that interpretation. If you see that it's like just this surfeit of empathy. Now, if I were writing the show, I would want it to be psychic, because if it's a psychic, it solves a lot of problems if it's psychic. It's a much simpler thing to do, and it gets you into more stories. But I also think it's the more inferior and commonplace to go with the idea that he's simply psychic. It takes something away from him, to me, in a sense, to say that, well, he's just got these psychic abilities, whereas you say instead he has, and he's nurtured, you know, at the cost of his family, you know, his career, even his sanity at points, this, you know, extreme empathy. And I mean, and talk about how much we need empathy in our world. To me, that's the superior configuration of this. But the other people just say, no, he's psychic. Yeah, I get it. And I get why you just want him to be psychic, because that just solves so many storytelling problems. But in my heart, I feel like that's the inferior paradigm, but feel free to disagree with
me. Go on, Adam.
So no, I agree with you. I agree with you, John. So I think it's clear that was Chris Carter's original intent that it was empathy. And I think Frank Spotnitz describes it as something like exquisite sensitivity or something like that, which is what it is. And to me, and it's clear that then in later episodes, there are certain developments that contradict that. But I think that was the intent. And it feels I feel superior, as you say, John, and I think it fits with the themes of the show more. So when you think about Chris Carter wanted to explore this notion of evil and how we've come up with these scientific explanations for it, but actually he was interested in the more biblical explanation and how we've been desensitized to the notion of evil, and therefore it fits to me. I think that then Frank Black is the most sensitive to evil that anyone could possibly be, and that it is therefore this sort of sensitivity and empathy that is developed, as opposed to, as you say, I think the more straightforward, as you say, John, but inferior sort of explanation, therefore, that it's just psychic. So I think it's actually more interesting that it's that sensitivity.
The single blade of grass episode as well, I think they had production issues on that one. There's moments when he's going to that other plane with the crows flying out, and there's no actual indication that he's having that vision, you know, because in likes of even like the likes of the Mikado, for example, we mentioned the Mikado before, where he's looking at a TV screen and he's saying, I can't get the feeling of what I need to be able to be that. And you could take that quite empathically, actually, with the fact that he's looking at a screen and it's cold and he's just not available to take it. So yeah, I think you're right with the storytelling aspect. It definitely gives you more more of an idea of storytelling elements if you wanted to go down that psychic route. Or I think the way I sort of described it in my recording of, I think it was 522666, was that the second episode, single blade of grass, it felt like he was getting to a plane rather than being psychic itself. It's kind of like he's reaching a plane of existence rather than being psychic. So there's even like another take on that as well. In the first couple of seasons, we obviously have his wife and Jordan, and I think we'll even bring in the Yellow House at this point, and the theme that the show uses the Yellow House to some degree. And especially in the episode of Lamentation, when we get to the Bob Bletcher scenes in the basement, and on Catherine and Jordan and the Yellow House in retrospect of all of the seasons, where obviously there's quite a lot that happens, and they actually do leave the Yellow House for a bit and things like that. John, what were your thoughts on the themes using the Yellow House as a guiding light?
Well, I love that. I mean, and when I got to interview Lance Henriksen, I told him, the first house I painted it yellow after Millennium. I bought it, and my wife and I bought it in 1999, and we painted it yellow. It was white, but we did it in honor of Millennium, because there's just something so really beautiful and true about that idea of the home being the sanctuary, the place of light, painting away the darkness, as Chris Carter says. I love the use of the house as a symbol, and it's sort of like paradise in year one, paradise lost in year two, and in year three, it's like the dream. It's like not even possibility anymore, which is fascinating to me. And so I love how the house was used throughout the series. I think, you know, all of the great literature, art, whatever, you know, uses symbols. And to see a symbol like the Yellow House, to me, it just shows like the literary artistic underpinning of Millennium. Now, I think we get it, like, and I love the character of Jordan. I think she's an amazing character. Again, symbolic. I mean, she's innocence. She represents, you know, children always represent innocence and tomorrow. You know, you harm the children and you're harming our own future, our own tomorrow. So again, she was very powerful as a character and as a symbol as well. I think Catherine works better as a symbol than the fact that they knew what to do with her. You know, she was a counselor, but she wasn't often seen counseling.
Yeah.
Like, she was important as Frank's support. That was the symbol, but I felt like they never really decided how she should fit in. You know, the series was constructed in such a way that we have this place of safety and brightness, which is the Yellow House, and then we have Frank's life away from that. And just the very nature of those stories, it means Frank is going to be going away from light and yellow and happiness in every episode into the darkness and then coming back at the end. I mean, I can't imagine that was particularly rewarding for Megan Gallagher. You know, she was like, I'm here at the beginning to support you, and I'm here at the end. But in terms of an actually well-developed character, I don't think they ever really figured out how to use Catherine beyond her importance as a symbol. Like that, the house, I mean, it's not a personality, you know what I mean? So it's great as a symbol. Jordan does have a personality, but again, as a child, we're not like looking into, expecting to have such a developed character because she's just a kid. You know what I mean? So again, she worked very well, but Catherine, I don't think the series ever really nailed what we were supposed to think about Catherine until Sound of Snow. I just got to keep going back to that episode. I thought the way she was used in that episode was perfect. But like when she was alive, I think, they almost had to create like artificial conflict to keep her in it, to keep her involved, to keep something going between her and Frank. And that made her seem at times like an arbitrary character. Like, wait, why are you mad at Frank? You know what Frank's going through and you're leaving him? What? You go back and look at some of that. Yeah, I just don't think they ever got that quite right with Catherine.
I mean, Adam, you've got also as well, just to throw in there for you, you've got the well-worn look, and I think it's Amnesis in season two with Lara. So they did try to place her in there, and Sound of Snow, we can always go back to that. It's no problem at all for me. So there was a couple of attempts to bring her in, and there was occasional moments, especially in season two, where it was almost like the marriage was breaking up because of the other, which was the Millennium Group, effectively it was pulling them apart, really. So with those in mind as well, how did you think that Catherine and Jordan fared?
Yeah, so I agree with everything John just said. It was brilliantly put, John. I very much enjoyed those episodes where Catherine was given something more to do, and I also wish they'd found more ways of doing that across the course of the series. And Megan Gallagher's great as Catherine when she has stuff to do. But as you say, she was more of this sort of symbol, and it was it just coming back to the Yellow House for a moment. That sort of the fact that we cared so much about the Yellow House, and it was this shining emblem of hope, when the sort of slow desecration of it. So the home invasion by Lucy Butler, and then as that went on into season two, as Frank has to leave, and then the house is empty, and so on. It's absolutely heartbreaking, and I think that speaks to the power of that symbol. But in terms of Catherine, I do wish that they'd found more ways of integrating it, because I think it was an interesting role that she had, professional role that she had, that could have been brought into some of the stories a little bit more than it was, but perhaps just didn't fit with the direction that they were seeking to go. And then in terms of Jordan, of course, touching back on the gift again as well, there was these hints that became stronger that actually that Jordan had some sort of gift as well, and that raises questions as to the nature of Frank's gift, and has he passed on that sensitivity, or is, again, does it speak to the more sort of psychic thing? So I think that was interesting as well, and some of the best character moments from Frank and some of the best acting from Lance is in reference to Jordan. So in Monster, when he's describing her birth, in Borrowed Time, when he thinks she's going to die, some of those moments that are in reaction to Jordan, but at least in Borrowed Time, very much incorporated her very well into the story too.
Where we hit the pass really with the gift is at the end of Saturn Dreaming of Mercury, where they're both looking into the window at the flaming house and they see Lucy Butler. I think that really hits home with the Jordan Black thing. Now, we have mentioned Lucy Butler. I might as well let's go there. So I think I'm gonna package this slightly different than just talking about Lucy Butler, and talk more about the idea of the Legion sort of mythology of the show, and even like sort of you mentioned Borrowed Time there, for example, you've got Borrowed Time and Lamentation. I know that they potentially could be the same person, the two kids there, the Samuel and Samuel. Could potentially be the same person as potential angels that are out there to protect Frank in some ways. I know in Lamentation he basically says it was a coincidence that would be the case, but that he was there for a particular role. But then you've got Lucy Butler, you've got people like the Judge, and I think Pepper in Lamentation as well. There's a few passes on this kind of Legion mythology that's popular with a lot of fans. What were your thoughts on that, Adam? Overall, as part of the mythology,
I think it's very interesting. It comes back to the central question as to what evil is, right? So, is it a force, or is it just a sort of dark influence that some people fall prey to. And again, I think that was one of Chris Carter's one of the questions he was seeking to explore. And the notion of Legion, I think, is interesting because it sort of introduces this almost binary logic of evil. If as soon as you say that evil is an entity and you build the sort of mythology around Legion, you're sort of separating the sort of good characters versus evil characters, and that is interesting as one perspective. But then, of course, the series went on to explore other perspectives. So Frank kills someone at the beginning of season two, in beginning of the end. Again, another spoiler for those who've yet to explore the show. And as we've touched upon, Catherine's response to that is that she's not sure that he necessarily did anything wrong, but that raises some interesting questions again about, was that an evil thing to do? Has he stepped over a line? So I think having Legion as part of the overall canvas of the series, I thought was fantastic because it helps to explore those questions. I think just having it as part of a larger whole was more interesting to me. I don't know if we're going to go on and perhaps talk about the group and the nature of the group, but again, the nature of how evil then can propagate in something such as the Millennium Group, and then you start to see perhaps Legion infiltrating there as well, is also interesting. So I think to me it was most interesting as part of that question as to, well, is evil some sort of force or entity and that sort of biblical description of it versus a more psychological approach, and the constant sort of dialogue between those two elements was one of the most interesting elements of the series.
Oh, I think the even like the Goodbye to All That, the last episode of the show before it went cross on the crossover, that very question was asked, wasn't it? You know, is evil born or can it be instilled in that person? I think Frank says something along the lines of, it's all within us, or something along those lines. I'm paraphrasing there a little bit.
Yes.
What about yourself, John, with regards to the Legion and the way that Millennium dealt with the kind of evil aspects of the show?
I think you both said it so well. I think I would just add that I think it's fascinating to me. You know, Lucy Butler is so fascinating for obvious reasons. really what we're talking about is these various interpretations of evil, just as you both said. But and Lucy Butler's is this idea that evil is seductive and evil is alluring, and you know, she sure makes it interesting. You know, she's a fascinating character to have on the show, and we learn, you know, in Room with a View that, you know, she's been around a while, at least in this form, right?
Yeah.
You know, definitely suggesting that she is not exactly human, or that evil likes that form. You know, this is just one of the great things about Millennium. I guess I would just say to people who are going to look at it and watch it or revisit it, you know, just sort of be thinking about like all these things, like about how the show views evil and different ways you can interpret these things, like Lucy Butler. You know, is she just a particularly, you know, evil person? Is she some sort of immortal being? Is she part of this evil thing? I don't know. To me, it's just really fascinating. I think that, you know, we ask ourselves questions about evil all the time. And, you know, you talk about the 90s and, golly, it's almost the 20th anniversary of Columbine at this point, the Columbine shootings. And there was even, you know, episodes that sort of tackled that issue. You know, those are the questions we were asking in the 90s and we're still asking, is, you know, what is evil? Is evil a system that lets terrible things occur? Is evil an entity? Is evil in our hearts? I don't know. It's great philosophy. That's for sure.
And I think the fact that you, if I could just jump in, that the fact you mentioned a Room with No View, that was a very interesting element of that episode, in that what Lucy Butler's trying to do is destroy someone's spirit. And it's kind of that notion of evil is in opposition to life. It's trying to kill your spirit. It's not trying to physically kill you, murder you, but it's trying to destroy your spirit. And that sort of reading of evil, I think, is very interesting. The very interesting way that they use Lucy Butler in that episode.
From Lamentation and Antipas, there's this theme of the child that was lost and the child that she wants to have with Frank. What did you think of that aspect of her character?
I struggled with a little bit in Antipas. That seemed a little less interesting to me than I think her attempts to influence behavior and so on. That wasn't one of her best for me, honest.
I agree with that. That's why I said Adam, because I was going to let you say it first, but
I thought it might be a loaded question, put it that way.
I feel that's sort of the least of the three Lucy Butler stories. I mean, it comes off a little bit like The Omen or something like that, which is fine. You know, for me, what's fascinating in that episode is her attempted seduction of Frank, and you know, and Frank's sort of in the moment response to her. You know, I think that's much more interesting than the like evil child of powerful politician plot, which we've seen like a lot of times before.
I know that she mentions the kid in Lamentation, and I thought they were trying to play something with that and give her like a through line, but I don't think it worked personally. We haven't mentioned someone who actually has been in the show for some considerable time and actually was a co-lead as well. We mentioned Emma Hollis. We haven't mentioned Laura Means yet. What were your thoughts on Laura Means? I kind of mentioned about Samuel being these angels or these beings that are doing particular things, especially in like borrowed time, where you know we've got that aspect of this supernatural thing happening. But Laura Means has an open window, and we get to see that Frank's mother might have similar things with the angels that she sees. So what were your thoughts on the Laura Means character, and how do you think that played out through the second season when she was involved? Because she obviously has one of the iconic millennium moments in towards the end of season two as well. So, what thoughts on that, Adam?
I loved Laura Means. She's a great character, and you're right. So as well as injecting a bit of humor, the whole "here's my thing" and the way she spoke sometimes and the way she challenged Frank, I think she was a very good foil to his character, and the way that she was introduced, so by the group, they kind of set Laura Means and Frank Black almost against one another in Monster. Her arc was very interesting. The as you say, it's one of the great moments. That whole sequence of her descent into madness and her arc across the season is interesting. And also how it relates, as you say, to Frank's mother and also to Jordan. It was a way of Frank being able to explore, try to understand a little about what Jordan's gift might be. And of course it spoke to the more supernatural consideration of evil when we start introducing angels and demons a little bit more to the series as well. So I think she was a real asset to that second year.
Yeah, I agree. She was an asset to the second year. I really liked her, and I liked her the more I got to know her. You know, the more time we spent with her, the more I liked her. At first I was worried because the "here's my thing," I think I counted. And she said it like five times in her first episode. I was like, oh my gosh, you know, you're bludgeoning us with a catchphrase. Don't do this. You know, to me, it started, it was a little worrisome at first. But then as the episodes went on, her character just deepened to where we got that absolutely brilliant descent, as I think Adam said it was, into madness. I mean, that's exactly what it was, to that stunning montage, you know, in the end and tragic ending. So, I believe she was a real asset to the show. I love that actress, Kristen Cloak. I loved her in Space Above and Beyond. I know that X-Files, The Field Where I Died, is not very popular because I guess it proposes that somebody besides Scully was Mulder's soulmate. But I thought she was fascinating in that episode. I loved her in Final Destination. I was thrilled to see her as Laura Means. So I was a little worried when she first appeared because the catchphrase was a little overdone, but you know, I was sold by, you know, week two or week three with her.
I loved her in Field Where I Died. I'm in the minority, is one of my favorite X-File episodes. So it's
it's a great
fantastic. Yeah, I love it a bit. So Laura Means had a great season arc there, and the fact that, you know, she basically sacrifices herself to help save Jordan as well, which is an interesting little section there. But we've got to talk about we've got two more people I think we need to discuss, really. Emma Hollis we'll speak about after this one, but we talked about Peter Watts. But Peter Watts has an interesting thing to play. Terry O'Quinn is a fantastic actor. I've loved him in everything he's done. He's just a brilliant actor. I absolutely love him. I'm rewatching Lost at the moment, and I just, Locke is just an incredible character. But his story with, especially the likes of later on in season three, where he's having to play, you mentioned before about the having to, the Millennium Group have gone down this route of being now the nemesis to Frank, and Frank's investigating them. And Peter's having to walk this line of being, you know, his confidant, the person he tried to bring into the group, but also as well being a bit of a nemesis to him as well. But then you get episodes like Collateral Damage. What did you think overall from Peter's point of view, John, that from his kind of expositional pieces that he did have beginning of season one to the inevitable end in Goodbye to All That in the finale of Millennium?
I think he's a great character, as I mentioned, a really tragic character. That story, that exposition he tells Frank about the child in the cooler that he finds, and how he, yeah, and how that child, like, in his mind became his child. You murdered my child. I found that very powerful, but like, that was just the first piece. Then the next piece, I mean, it's really interesting because this is sort of how a cult works. He became, you know, after like dealing with that horrible tragedy, it was like he found a place that he came to believe fully and trust fully, which was the Millennium Group. And he stopped seeing the Millennium Group for what it actually was. And I mean, began doing all of these horrible things for them, even against people who he knew were his friends, like Frank. Again, I just have to say, this is a comment on how easily we're divided, whether it's by political affiliation or religious affiliation, is that Peter Watts had this moment of weakness. The group capitalized on it, and he became so dogmatic in his beliefs that he did things which an earlier version of himself would have found abhorrent. And again, I don't want to give away any spoilers, but he redeems himself, but at great cost. Let's just say it that way. You know, at the end of the series, I think it's a great arc, especially if you consider, as we talked about before, all the tumult that was going on behind the scenes, and how each season is sort of a redraft of what, you know, every season sort of goes on a different trajectory than what you expect. But you can watch all three seasons, and this is why I love Millennium, and sort of track what is happening to Peter, you know, and yeah, why he is who he is. So I find that absolutely fascinating. I think he's an amazing character, and I totally agree with you, Kurt, about O'Quinn. He's just Terry O'Quinn. He's just an amazing actor. Fantastic.
Yeah, so I agree with everything John's just said, as usual. There was a hint right from the pilot, and this is one of the reasons I love the pilot. It's so dense in terms of all the things, the opportunities and possibilities that it opens up. But even in the pilot, when he first appears, he's standing in the shadows across from the Yellow House, and there was a sense there of this sort of slight danger or mysterious nature to the character. So I feel it was sort of seeded right from the start that perhaps he wasn't entirely to be trusted. And then he became sort of emblematic of the group's own divisions and the problems with the group. There was a book that I read when we were putting together the Back to Frank Black book called People of the Lie by an author called M. Scott Peck, who's a psychiatrist, and he became interested in what evil was from a standpoint of a therapist. And one of the things he said in there was that any specialized group is prone to narcissism and believing that they are supremely right. And Peter Watts' arc was kind of taking that to the extreme. You add in the religious dogma, as John's talked about as well, and it really dived into that the sort of possibilities of that and how far you could take it. And so I found that arc fascinating. As John says, you can follow it through the three seasons. At the end of the second season, there's a sense that actually there's an element of doubt. And again, at the end of the third season, there is that sense that there may be some reconciliation between him and Frank for a time at least. So, yeah, great character, great actor. And again, yeah, fascinating arc.
You mentioned Emma Hollis. The reason why I've kept her to last is because obviously she is in the third season. It's the final season. Her character arc is almost in some ways similar to Frank's story in a condensed format that the Millennium Group kind of tried to poach her as well. She was one of your favourite characters Adam, what did you particularly like about the Emma Hollis arc as such in the third season? From a shallow person's point of view, I remember some of the things being thrown at Millennium at the time was, oh, they've just going back to an X-Files light, going back to Washington, and you know, now he's got a female lead, which I don't agree with, but there was that element thrown at the show. But what did you think of Emma Hollis's act?
Yeah, and I'm with you. I didn't feel that it was like an X-Files light or whatever. But the notion of her as a mentee to Frank Black as a mentor, I think worked very well. That was an interesting dynamic there. And again, the fact that ultimately she gets drawn in by the group and she makes perhaps some not great decisions, made for an interesting arc. It's one of the things that how it is left at the end of the third season makes it all the more tantalizing to see them come back for a fourth season and see what might have happened next, given where her character's been pushed to. But again, it's quite a tragic arc. The story with her her father and how it gets exploited by the group is quite tragic.
Yeah, I think Emma Hollis was a great character. I remember hearing the same thing, that she's, you know, basically going to be Scully, what have you. But I think that when you look at the Frank female partnerships over the years, they never quite figured it out with Catherine. With Laura, I think they got closer, but I really think they got it with Emma, because we already see Frank as a father figure. Yeah. And you know, he has that in his personal life with Jordan, but he's like her professional father figure. And that's not just about like solving cases, but like, how do you confront injustice, evil, all those things. So for me, that relationship really worked because, well, Catherine was gone. So that, like, you know, with Laura and Catherine, you know, at some point it's like, okay, they're both there. You know, it's like, is this going to be something, you know?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? But it's like, you know, Frank was just free to be Frank with Emma. He was a fatherly influence in her life, a mentor. And to me, that was, so that relationship was probably the best sort of adult female, adult male relationship in the series with Frank and her. Just to me seemed to work best. And I absolutely agree. Her arc is heartbreaking, but it's great because, you know, we are left to put together the pieces based on what Peter Watts has told us about how, you know, his arc that I was just talking about a minute ago. But we actually get to see Emma's play out in before our eyes in slow motion. So it's like, wow, would I have chosen any differently? I mean, that's how evil gets to you, right? There's somebody that you love. I mean, if someone came to me and said, you need to, my son were sick, and they said, we can save your son's life, but you have to do this thing for us. Yeah, I'm going to do it. I mean, yeah, right. It's terrible to say, but I mean, the Millennium Group hits you where you are weak, and to see this amazing character who is so brilliant sort of be left with no alternative but to do that is really haunting. And again, just because we never did get that fourth season where I hope it would have been resolved favorably for her, it's like we're left with that she has taken that slide into working with evil. That's where we leave her. You know, we had the descent into madness for Laura in season two. And we have, you know, Emma's complete capitulation to a group she knows that is evil at the end of season three. It's just very powerful.
So my question to both of you would be, what are your thoughts of the Millennium Group from its inception in season one to what it became in season three? How do you view the Millennium Group, John?
Well, I think it's fascinating. I think that what we are faced with is the idea of this group that has been around for a long time and has gotten close to the halls of power and is deeply intertwined with the halls of power and is looking out very closely for what it believes. And if you're down with that, then that's great. But if you're not down with what it believes, you know, skull and bones, right? Watch out. I think there's something very truthful about it, but not, and I want to put an asterisk, not about the Academy Group. I don't think they did the, officially not. But I mean, I think the idea of, you know, a clandestine group of people who think they're doing the right thing, you know, sort of being perverted into evil. I mean, I think that's something that everybody can sort of relate to and see. And I mean, you know, I know some people get really upset that like the Millennium Group was flat out evil in the third season. But I say, like, weren't you watching season two? didn't you see where this was headed? Right. You know, even from season one, where these are just, you know, former FBI professionals, they're so cloaked in secrecy. I guess the definition of evil in America, you know, at least one definition is to have this level of secrecy in a place that's supposed to be open and serving the people is quite terrifying. I mean, you know, we've had governments obsessed with secrecy, making laws to preserve secrecy, things like that. And I mean, I think that's what the Millennium Group is keying on. And again, I guess it's great if you support their agenda. If you don't, though, then you just see it as a, you know, as being almost a revolutionary group with frightening power. You couldn't have come back from season two and said the Millennium Group is okay.
No,
you just couldn't, right?
Yeah.
Right. After, you know, releasing the virus in the Pacific Northwest, I mean, how are you going to do that? So I'm really happy with the way the Millennium Group developed, because it started out Frank on the outside, not really knowing about it, and his questions were sort of rebuffed. Then as he's initiated going into it, he has questions about it. Why is it the way it is? And as he starts to see it, he really doesn't like what it's doing. And then, of course, he finds out what it's doing, and he becomes a committed enemy to it. That, I mean, I think that's a great arc, too.
Yeah, it's almost like a three-act structure, isn't it, really?
Yeah, great. Yes, that's brilliant, yeah.
Okay, so, Adam, what about yourself?
Yeah, so, again, I agree with all of that, and I think it was ripe to be explored. As I say, there was the hints, even from the pilot, of maybe there was a sort of dark sense to the nature of the group. And as I mentioned before, this sort of idea of a specialized group that becomes sort of narcissistic, and then you throw in the religious dogma and taking that to an extreme as to what that could lead to. And I think it's interesting as well, because you look at the constructs of law and order historically have been sort of inextricably linked with organized religion. And so the sort of historical elements of the Millennium Group that we glimpse, and the fact that the religious dogmas really invaded their sense of who they are and their purpose and the infighting that leads to and so on, I think is very interesting, and we're right to absolutely separate it from the Academy Group in real life, but in the fictionalized world of Millennium, it seems a very sort of obvious thing to go after and explore in more detail and push to the limits as they did, and was fascinating.
Right, okay, we are at our final question, gentlemen, and then you'll be initiated into the Millennium Group. The time is now. So we're going to be starting our episodes as well with the catchphrase "Soylent Green is people," which is obviously the password that is used in season two. As part of your initiation, the final question is, what is your favourite moment from the series? I would go with Adam first on this one.
I'm glad I don't have to shed any blood or recite Latin to be initiated. I just have to answer this question, but this is almost as difficult. So again, I've struggled with all of these questions, and the one on moments, I think we've touched on some of the iconic moments. So Lucy Butler in the basement of the Yellow House was one that I thought about. Laura Means Descent into Madness. Even as I'm thinking about these, I'm not quite sure what I'm going to pick, to be perfectly honest. The moment that Frank is he discusses Jordan being born in Monster, I think, is one of Lance's finest performances in anything that I've seen him do, which is, I'd say, is high praise, because I love so much of what he's done. I also like his opening monologue, actually, in the beginning and the end, that sort of opening statement that we have, I think is fantastic. But I'm going to come back to an episode that we've touched upon a few times, and it's the sort of dream or the moment he has with Catherine in The Sound of Snow, I think is such a beautiful scene and gives some real closure to what he's been through in that sort of conversation he's having with Catherine or with himself in the woods at the climax of The Sound of Snow. I think because of how beautiful that moment is, I think I'm going to pick that.
I cannot top that. That is lovely. Adam, I loved all your favorite. You just hit all of them. You know, I'm trying to think almost like the images that just pop out to me, and like one of Frank's visions almost, you know, that when I think of Millennium, what are the images that flood back to me? One is absolutely horrifying, and it's the clown with the upside down head hanging from the ceiling.
Yeah.
From a very early episode, was it, which one was that? I can't remember which episode, but early first season, that just being something like unexpectedly, just like absolutely horrible, from Jordan's dream. Then there was, in Luminary, Frank, like diving into the water, I think it was, to save the boy
who
fell down a hill. Like just his instantaneous reaction to like jump into the dangerous river to save him. He was so invested in this. And then the image that and it's crazy, but it just always stays with me, and I'll never forget it. And I think it says so much about Millennium. This is the first one that comes to my mind, you know, with all of the adventures of Frank Black and all the dark things he encountered. But it's Jordan like licking his face in the pilot, where he shows her the yellow house for the first time, and she just spontaneously sticks her tongue out, like licks his nose or his face. And there was something just so natural and innocent about that, and talking about who Frank Black is. So I don't know if those are the greatest moments, or just the images that when I think of Millennium jump out at me. But that, you know, that's their first time seeing the yellow house. So the yellow house is in there too, but she's happy, and she kind of just, her little tongue shuts out, and she...
Yeah, and I think that was a spontaneous moment as well from her, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. So, it was, I think. Yeah, it's a great choice there. Great moment. Really good choice. We both chose character moments as well. They're very sort of strong character moments, which is interesting.
Yeah. Well, in mine, I chose, I think from memory serves me right, because as you know, these things change from day to day, was the time is now, Laramine's fallout. But one of the things, as a Darren Morgan fan, is the... it is when he's looking into the bathroom and he says, "You must be so lonely." His killer, Darren Morgan, has those killer lines at the end of all of his episodes. And that's just another one in Somehow Satan Got Behind Me, which is fantastic. Which is I think we have three. I don't think there's any more episodes that are lighthearted. I think there was only the three, wasn't there? There was Somehow Satan Got Behind Me, the Jose Chung's Doomsday Defense, and the 13 Days.
Right. 13
years later, yeah. So we only had three, which I mean, Darren Morgan, I know that he didn't do the third one, but he's a particularly favourite of mine from the X-Files. Jose Chung's Smart Space is incredible. So that is the final five questions. You are now inducted into the Time Is Now podcast, so congratulations.
Thank you very much.
We will no doubt hear you on future episodes. I know that I don't know if you've recorded any yet, but you're definitely on the list to be involved. So it'd be good to hear you on the airwaves again. In the meantime, though, where can we find you both online? So Adam, first of all, where can we find you online?
So I am on Twitter. You'll find me Adam_Chamberlain, but spelled BRLN at the end, because I have such a long name. And also fourthhorsemanpress.com. So we've talked about the book a little bit. You can read it and find out where to buy the book if you haven't read it and you're interested to, there at fourthhorsemanpress.com.
Okay. And have you got anything in the pipeline at the moment that you'd like to let anyone know about at all, or?
In terms of Fourth Horseman Press, so we've recently released a book actually called Cinema U, which is looks at representations of education in film in particular. We have one or two other things that we're looking at that I won't talk about yet, because we're still in the sort of throes of mulling them over, so we will announce in the near future.
Keep an eye on that. Okay, and John.
Yes, so I am at JK Muir on Twitter and John Kenneth Muir on Facebook. I'm still blogging at my site, which is Reflections on Film and Television Blogspot. And I'm currently working on Horror Films of the 2000s, which is the fourth book in a series I've been working on since the year 2000, where I did Horror Films of the 1970s, which was, I guess, 2001, Horror Films of the 1980s, which came out in 2007, and Horror Films of the 90s, which came out in, I think, 2012. So I'm only now, I guess I'm about maybe 150 5,200 films in of 400 films I'm watching and reviewing for the decade of the 2000s.
Fantastic. Well, you can find me online at R Muldrake, at R-M-U-L-D-R-A-K-E. You'll also find this podcast on at The Time Is Now Pod, part of the We Made This podcast network. But in the meantime, all that's left for me to say is I hope you enjoy this podcast. We are going to go through all 67, I believe, episodes of the show. And we have some interviews with some guest stars as well. So keep an eye out for that in the coming weeks. There'll be announcements on who we have interviewed. But we will be signing off with This Is Who We Are.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black, who co-produces alongside Kurt North. You can find the show on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod, and on Facebook if you type in The Time Is Now. Plus, we have a Facebook fan group called The Yellow House, full of active Millennium discussion. The Time Is Now is also part of the We Made This podcast network at We Made This Pod, alongside a range of popular culture shows about TV, film, music, and beyond, including our sister show, The X-Cast, an X-Files podcast. For advanced access to The Time Is Now and access to bonus material, consider supporting The X-Cast and We Made This on Patreon at patreon.com/The X-Cast. That's patreon.com/The X-Cast. You'll find a full range of subscription tiers available. Thanks for listening.